You are listening to the Passion City Church podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, I mentioned a few weeks ago that because of an interesting set of circumstances, I've been able to spend quality time with Navy SEALs, one of the great honors of my life to be able to do that. And it was several years ago that I went with some of them to an assault training. And I watched a group of them traverse through a field up to a house filled with enemy combatants to take down that house and to rescue hostages. And it was a simulation, so they were using simunition rounds in their weapons, paintballs. But they're fired out of real weapons, and so they go fast and hard and hurt. So my understanding when I showed up is that I would be watching this whole exercise from the safety of an observation deck. But as I got there and I stood with their commanding officer, their CO at one point, as we watched these men move through this field and they begin to stack up on the door about to go in, he motioned to me to start walking towards the door with him. And as we got closer and closer to it, at one point, he stopped me and he said, "I wouldn't get any closer. When they blow that door, sometimes the handle shoots off like a bullet. I'd stay right here." And I was like, "Yeah, we're already much closer than I thought I would be. So this feels fine to me." But sure enough, they blew the door. They went running into the building. And then at that moment, he hit me on the chest and said, "Let's go." And he went charging into the door. So I went charging in after him in jeans and a t-shirt. And I remember as soon as I walked through the door, two things struck me, metaphorically speaking. The first thing was the chaos of the situation. It was crazy. There was smoke everywhere, tight corners, shot fired, flashbangs. It was nuts in there. And then the second thing that hit me was the beauty of their strategy, that they were aggressive but graceful. They were purposeful but controlled. I would watch two of them come to an open hallway, and then with barely a nod, they would move out in unison, so instantly eliminating threats while covering each other and being minimal time as an open target. And within seconds, they had eliminated all threats, rescued all hostages, and taken a chaotic situation and brought peace and order and life. And I remember as I watched that, I thought, this is incredible. This is the Christian life. Or it should be. And you say, "What do you mean by that?" Well, I don't know where you are on your spiritual journey, but I would say this about all of us. It doesn't take too long to begin to start to live a spiritual life. I want to know God. I want intimacy with God to start to figure out that a life of spirituality comes in a context of adversity. And some of you have felt that even this January. You thought, "You know, I want to know God more. I'm going to read my Bible every day." And what happened on January 2nd as the alarm went off? You're like, "I don't know, maybe the 3rd, right? Or even if you did get up and start to read it, suddenly all kinds of rival thoughts and competing affections come into that moment. You're like, "Why can I not focus?" The pursuit of spirituality happens in the context of adversity. And for some of us, if we're honest, we've been discouraged by that situation. You just thought it'd be easier. You thought, "I want to live with God. I want to know God. I want to live that kind of life." And yet this situation is difficult. And you're like, "I don't know what I expected. I guess I thought that when I really started to walk with God, something would change, that when I came to know Jesus, I just would never struggle anymore and would always feel peace and always love everybody and just fly around and sprinkle Jesus dust on everyone." And it's been weird. It's not like that. And maybe you've listened to testimonies in places like this of someone coming on stage and be like, "Yeah, man, I was addicted to heroin. Went to one service, put my faith in Jesus, and I never struggled with temptation again. God just ripped all the temptation out of by the roots and threw it away. And now I live an impossibly glorious life." And we all clap because that is possible and that's amazing. And yet for some of you, you hear that story and you're like, "He uprooted your addiction? Man, he didn't even prune mine. It's still all there, as robust as ever." And some of you say, "Man, I've got some struggles in me and I've prayed for him to take that struggle away and he hasn't. So does God even see me? Does he even like me?" And for some of you, you don't have this great passionate pursuit of God that you want. Because the reality is this constant static of a low-grade guilt is humming in the background of your life and it is stealing the joy out of your story. And some of you, if we can just be honest, that wet blanket of persistent failure has extinguished your passion and affection for God. And you're looking at it going, is this the best it can get? Is this the best I can do? Is this the best I can hope for in my life? And you're discouraged by the situation. Or others of you, you go, no, I know the situation's hard. I know life's brutal. I know it's terrible. I know I'm going to struggle. Man, I get that situation. I just need a strategy. I need to step out into the dangers of this world and look more like a Navy SEAL and less like you. I mean, they came into that chaos equipped, ready for battle. I feel like you running in flip-flops going, it's smoky in here. And you're like, I need someone to give me a strategy of how to be more successful in my life, right? And that's what we're talking about here today, because you go, maybe some of the strategies I've been doing aren't really working. And so here's the thing. My goal in this series is not to give you a pump-up speech. This isn't me in the locker room circling you all up and be like, let's get in here. Let's get a break and go get him, man. That's not what this is. This isn't me with half my face painted blue going, freedom! Like, that's not what this sermon is. I almost want, in an unemotional way, and certainly not in a shame-filled way, to look at our life and say, what's the situation we're in, and what's a strategy to begin to see progress in our spiritual life? That's the goal today. And so I want to look at our situation and then look at our strategy. And the situation is this: a pursuit of intimacy with God happens in the context of adversity. That's how we launched this series. That's the reality. That as much as Jesus Christ was presented as a lamb and as a shepherd, he's also presented as a warrior. 1 John 3 says it, the Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. That Jesus came to destroy something. You saw it in Genesis. As God created the world, he enters chaos and exerts himself on it to bring order, but not a stifling order, an order that allows life to be conducive. And then humanity embraced chaos, and all that order broke down. And in the midst of that chaos, God said in Genesis 3, I am sending the seed of a woman. I'm sending a boy, and he will crush the head of the one who deceived you. God's solution to our sin was a savior, not a list of laws, a liberator. I'm sending a hero to beat back the darkness, to bring back peace, to create a new structure in which we can flourish. I'm sending a warrior. So that's why when Jesus showed up, he said, I am here as a landed invasion. But not just a landed invasion, it's a rescue operation. In his first sermon in Luke 4, he said, I have come to proclaim release to the captives. That's why I'm here. You are captive, and I'm here to set you free. You're in chains, and I am the chain breaker. Or you are under the power of a strong one, but the stronger one is here. That's what he said in Luke 11. He says, when a strong man fully armed guards his house, his possessions are undisturbed. But when someone stronger than he attacks him and overpowers him, he takes away from him all his armor on which he relied and distributes his plunder. That's how Jesus described his mission. He says, you are captives of a strong spiritual power, but the stronger one's here. And I'm here to kick some tail, strip him naked, throw him aside and rescue you. That's why I'm here. That's the gospel of Jesus. A landed invasion. A rescue operation. He says, we have been transferred out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of the beloved Son. That's what God's in the business of doing. That's what Jesus has done, coming to you in your darkness, not saying clean yourself up, saying I have come to liberate you. I'm transferring you out of the domain of the dark, and I'm giving you a new name and a new identity and a new future. I am calling you into something that it's a landed invasion, a rescue operation, but it's also an ongoing mission. That God in his wisdom has allowed the remnants of sin's once proud reign to still remain. In you, in me, in the world. And so God calls us. I love the way C.S. Lewis said it. He said, enemy-occupied territory. That is what this world is. But Christianity is the story of the rightful king who has landed, you might say landed in disguise, and he is calling us all to take part in his great campaign of sabotage. That when you come to faith in Jesus, it's not a liberty from all your struggles. It is the liberty to struggle. Before, you didn't struggle well. You were just a victim. Now you can be a victor in Jesus' name. That's what happened to David in the Old Testament. Do you remember when the nation of Israel watched the Philistines encroach on their land, take over their villages, attack them? What would the nation of Israel do? It said they would come out every day to battle, shouting the war cry. But as soon as they saw Goliath, they would fold like a lawn chair and they'd go running back. And for some of us, that's you with making healthy life changes. Every January, you shout the war cry. I will read the Bible every day. I will stop eating carbs. I will be kind to my neighbors. I will be, and then the alarm clock goes off and you're like, I'm not ready, life is hard, right? And you just fold, an emotional cripple. What was the answer in Israel? It wasn't for them to get a pump up speech. It was for this David, that son of Bethlehem, to come and destroy Goliath. And do you remember what happened? When he beat their big enemy, what did they do? They suddenly felt empowered to shout the war cry and to drive the Philistines out of their land. Some of you, your discouragement over the last couple years is because you have some Philistines of addiction, of despair, of unhealthy choices relationally that are ravaging your land. What you need is not a war cry. What you need is to watch your hero beat death and sin and hell. And when you see him fight for you, that's what will empower you to drive the Philistines out of your life. That I join him in his mission of sabotage. Do you see it? There is still sin in us. The once proud reign of our addiction is there, but it's been deposed. And you know that before sin was the dictator in us, it controlled us. You would say, I want to make better choices. No, you can't. Okay, I can't. And that's the way it was. But Jesus has toppled that dictator in you, and you have a new king now, right? Now that little voice is still there. He was an evil dictator. Lost his job, but he's still an evil guy. And so some of you still have that voice inside of you. All of us do. That he's like, you're like, I'm going to date healthier. No, you're not. You will date a loser. Okay, I will. But now you don't have to listen to that voice. He's still evil, but he's not your master anymore. You have a new master and a new life in front of you. So how do I struggle well? The ones who know they've been fought for make the best fighters. When I know I have a king who beat hell for me, then I can beat the addictions in my life. That's our situation. You have the ability to overcome in Jesus' name. Now, the only question is, how do we do it? And I would say this, once you've put your faith in Jesus, spirituality is now one movement with two parts. Spirituality is now one movement with two parts. It's a movement away from something and a movement towards something. It's a movement away from ways of thinking and living that isolate us from intimacy with God, and a movement towards ways of thinking and ways of living that promote intimacy with God. Old school theologians had a name for this movement. They called it sanctification. The word sanctify is the same word in Greek as the word holy, and holy means set apart. And you hear it in that language. To say something is set apart means what? It's set apart away and towards. Away from certain things towards other. Like my wife is set apart only unto me. She is holy unto me. So that means none of you other losers can have her, right? Away from you towards me. That's what that means. Sanctification is a movement away and towards. And then they had words for each one of these parts. Old school theologians called this part mortification. Mortification, like there are things in my life that I mortify, I kill. They can no longer live in me. And they call this part vivification. But there's other things in my life, ways of thinking, ways of living that I want to help bring to life. I want to cultivate so that it can be more fruitful. If you want a gardening imagery, this is the uprooting of weeds. You're not welcome anymore. And this is the planting of flowers and fruit, right? If you want to dating imagery, like marriage, for me, this would be like dating my wife, talking with her about her emotions. This would be not dating other women. You see it? I'm moving away from these activities and towards these. If you want a simpler way, I call this the big no, and this the big yes. And some people, when they hear this part, they go, well, here it comes. That's what it is to be a Christian. Just no, you can't do that. You can't do that. Don't drink that. Don't touch her. It's all a bunch of no's. Well, no, it's not. That's only part of it. That knowing God is a free gift in Jesus. But then yes, once I know him, there are things I say no to, but that is to liberate me to a better yes. I have a new set of options that are better for me. And so that's the spiritual life now. If you want a verse for it, 2 Timothy 2:22 says, flee youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, love, joy, and peace, along with those who call out to God out of a pure heart. There are some things I now flee from, and there's some things I now pursue, right? That's the Christian life. Now, let me qualify in that. What I'm not saying is, this is kind of the devil side of the stage, and that's the God side stage. So get on that God side, everybody. That's not what I'm saying. because that makes it sound like God is over here with his arms folded waiting for you to get your crap together. And that's not the gospel. While we were sinners, Christ died for us. While we were lost, he came plunging into the dark to get us, right? Running after that prodigal son. And once you come to know him, he says, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. No matter what you're struggling with today, I am here with you in the fight. And yet here's the reality. I can be physically standing right next to my wife. And I know she will never leave me. But I can feel far away because I have not done the things that cultivate intimacy with her. Do you see it? So it's not a fight to keep the relationship. It is a fight to cultivate an unrestrained intimacy with the one who set me free. Do you see it? That's the spiritual life. So you go, okay, well then how do I do it? What's our strategy? Well, for today's purposes, we're just gonna focus on the big no. Now the reality is, this is not done in a vacuum. That we have an enemy and he hates you. Right? It's interesting. I remember for me, in the early days of junior high, I remember junior high was very exciting for me, partly because I was going to get to ride the bus to school, which was very cool. And I was going to get to ride the bus with my brother. And I was very excited about that because my brother was cool. And so we showed up at the bus and he was like, we're going to walk to the back of the bus because that's where the cool kids sit. And I was like, that makes sense. My brother's cool. I'm with him. So thus by proxy, I am cool. So here we go. And so I remember we got on the bus and as my brother walked to the back, I started following him. And then as soon as we were walking, suddenly a guy stood up between the two of us and got in my face. And he was doing that thing, which I learned later is what some guys do when they want to fight, where they get their nose really close to your nose. And I'm like, what's this level of intimacy? Like, your breath smells terrible. What are we doing? I didn't understand it. But he was trying to bow up on me, right? And what I discovered was he was a bully. I remember he looked at me and he said, are you Cole Stewart's brother? I said, yeah. He said, I hate your brother. I said, okay. And I wondered why, and I found out later why. It's because he was a bully. He got some unmet emotional needs met by picking on littler people, right? And yet there was a problem. He had decided to play football. And my brother played football and was better than him. So there was a day at practice where he was playing defense and my brother was running the ball. And rather than dodge around him, my brother just ran straight into him. And Martin went flying through the air and made like a squealing sound, like a piglet. And you know, when you're a bully, that really cramps your style. So it had hurt him personally. And so fast forward back to the bus moment, he looks at me and he said, you Cole Stewart's brother? And I said, yes, I am. He said, I hate your brother. And then he said, so I hate you. And then he took his finger and he pushed my face. And he said, you'll look good with a cigarette burn right here. And right as soon as he said that, we heard from the back of the bus, Martin! He backed up. But as he sat down, he looked at me and he said, it's going to be a long year, little brother. Now, what was his problem? I didn't do anything to him. I'll tell you what his problem was. I looked like the one who had shamed him. And that's you. The enemy hates God. What's the best way to get at God? Get at you? To get at you. So this isn't in a vacuum. The spiritual life happens in the context of adversity. We have an enemy, and we need to analyze how he works on us. We need to be like General Patton, one of the best movies ever made, Patton. You remember when he stepped out, it's uncertain if he can beat Rommel. Rommel, who has superior forces and training, had literally written the book on tank warfare. But as Patton got out there, he routed Rommel's army, and everyone was wondering, how did he do it? How did this young green general overcome Rommel? And do you remember at his moment of victory, Patton stood on that hilltop and said, Rommel, I read your book! And you realize that was a pretty good way to do it. Read his strategy so you can beat it, right? So I want to read the enemy's book. What does he know, and what does he do, right? I'll tell you what he knows is you. Specifically, your wiring and your tendencies. He knows your wiring. He knows that you have a mind, cognitive faculty, reasoning process. He knows you have a heart, affections, likes, dislikes, inclinations, aversions. And he knows you have a will, a decision-making mechanism. I choose this, I choose that. You are mind, affections, and will. Head, heart, hands. Every single one of us is that, right? He knows that about us. And he knows your tendencies. He's watched the particular tape on you, that you have certain things you have an inclination towards and certain things you have an aversion against. And that's true in every single one of us, the way we're uniquely made, even in things inane. Like if I just said the two words, romantic comedy, Some of you, I just say those two words, and as those two words are solicited to your mind, they consult your affections, and your affections go, because you think of Matthew McConaughey or Jake Gyllenhaal, and you're like, I love them so much. Oh my gosh, let's watch another one. Let's watch a million, even though it's the same plot over and over again. Others of us, those same two words are solicited to our mind, and when they consult our affections go, oh no, no, no. And someone says, let's watch one. You say, I can't. I got to go weed eat or lance a wound or just something else. He knows that about us. Now, what is his strategy? His strategy is to get you to sin. What is that? It's a willful decision to participate in ways of thinking or living that step away from intimacy with God. The best way to insult God is to get you to take a willful step away from him. That's the best way to hurt God. So he wants you to do that. You choose to walk away from the author of life. How does he do that? To get you to enact your will, he has to create an environment where that looks attractive. And so what he will do is solicit thoughts to your mind to stir your affections. And when you enact the will, you sin. Right? This environment of thoughts solicited to the mind to stir the affections is called temptation. Temptation. And you say, where are you getting this? James chapter 1, we read it. But each one is lured and enticed. What does that mean? To lure is to get the mind's attention. Entice is to stir the heart's affection. Each one is lured and enticed by his own desire. And when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Because there's a principle. What you think about is what you care about. And what you care about, you will chase. Do you see it? So ladies, let's say you're getting ready for work one morning and the thought is solicited to your mind. I'm single. And you think, that is true. I am not married, nor am I currently dating somebody. And as that thought solicits your affections, you say, but I want to be married. I want to be with someone. And then an Adele song comes on about saying hello from the other side. And you're like, I am on the other side. I don't even know what that means, but the stirring of affections and soliciting of thoughts, I don't want to be alone. And as that happens, you start making your way to work and you look around and you see couples walking hand in hand, and the animals going two by two. And as this is constantly solicited to your mind, your affections say, man, I want somebody, I don't want to be alone. And in that moment, the thought is propositioned to you. And you date a loser. You know he's beneath you morally. You know he doesn't have the interests of your great king. But you have been so wrapped up here that you believe this is the best you can get. Do you see it? What you think about, what you care about, will be what you chase. So the million-dollar question is, what do you entertain in your mind? Guys, you'll be living your life and the thought will be solicited to your mind. You should think about naked things. And you say, naked things? Okay. And that's about it for you. He's got the film on you. He knows. And he knows how you're wired. What you think about is what you care about. And what you care about, you will chase. So the million-dollar question is, what do you entertain in your mind? Because what you entertain will determine what you love and what you become. Do you see it? That's how it works. So 1 Timothy 4:16 says, keep a close watch on yourself and your teaching. Persist in this, for by doing so, you will save both yourself and your hearers. Do you see what Paul's telling young Timothy? He says, know this teaching, know what you believe. And then he says, and know yourself, Timothy. Be a good student of you. Know how this works with you. Because it's particular. Each one is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. It's tailor-made. He even uses the word lure. How does a lure work? What are you doing when you're fishing? I'm presenting something in front of a fish that I want to get its attention. And then I want to stir its affection. So maybe you get a lure like a frog. And you present it. What are you hoping for? The fish will go, well, hey there, little buddy. Right? Maybe you make it swim along sideways so it looks wounded and delicious. What's your hope? That it'll go, oh, hey there. And you don't just want its attention. You want its affections. Hey, I want to talk to you, right? And then when it enacts the will, it never even sees the hook. Do you see it? But some of you might go, a frog? Really? that's what you're into, that's disgusting. Like, ew. Like, if you're into that, I don't even know how you can call yourself a real fish, because that's disgusting, right? And that's fine. He got a different lure for you. He'll just pull out something else, and you go, ooh, shiny, rah, right? And off you go. Each one is lured and enticed by his own lust. Some of the best self-knowledge you can have today is, how does he get me? Because he's coming at all of us. Tailor-made. How does he get me? What thoughts does he solicit? What lies do I believe? What emotions does it stir? And then what actions are propositioned? Because if I don't want to be here, I need to understand the mechanics of how this works. Now you say, well, then what do I do? Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 26:41, watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. Do you hear what he said? He didn't just say, watch and pray that you don't enter sin. He said, watch and pray that you don't enter temptation. If this always leads here, then let me eliminate this. That's Jesus' strategy. What are the places I'm in that constantly solicit thoughts to the mind, to stir affections, to make me make decisions that I know will not be life-giving or healthy decisions for me? Then how do I eliminate this moment? So I had a buddy once that he said he was counseling with a friend of his, and he said his friend was telling him, man, I gotta talk to you, my life's a mess. He said, what? He was like, my wife and I have been arguing, we've been yelling at each other, screaming at each other, and last night we got physical. And my friend came at him hard, like, you don't put hands on your wife, bro, when you're upset. You need to. And he just came at him, hey, well, let's talk. And they began to process that. And he said, man, how is it happening? What's leading to these arguments? And he said what most people say when you ask them, like, I don't know, man, I don't even know. Like, no, you do, think about it. Watch, what's going on in your life? And he said, you know, man, we go out every Tuesday and we go to this bar. It's where we always go. It's where our friends go. And inevitably, as the night wears on, I don't like the way she talks to other men, and it bothers me, and she can tell it bothers me, but she keeps doing it. And so I feel disrespected, and she feels slighted by me. And so we get in the car and it turns into an argument. When we get home, if we've drank enough, it escalates and it goes crazy. My friend says, well, man, you don't need to process this alone. You need some counseling. You need some good health. There's some deeper things underneath this you need to get to. But maybe just to start, if this always leads here, then why don't you get out of this? And his friend's like, because it's Tequila Tuesday. And you're like, yeah, but it's not worth sinning over. Maybe just take a break, man. Or I'll talk to young couples. They say, hey, I just started dating this guy and we're trying to figure out if it's a good match. And so we're trying to hold off a lot of physicality because I don't want to get all kind of hot and bothered with our bodies and not really figure out if I even like this dude. So we're trying to stay pure while we're dating to figure out kind of what's going on in this relationship. And I'll have people say that and they go, but you know what? We keep slipping up. We keep doing stuff we don't want to do. We keep kind of doing stuff and we're kind of ashamed. It's brought guilt into our life. We don't like it. We don't like the way we're living, but we keep doing it. And I was like, okay, how does it happen? I don't know, man. Yeah, think about it. And you go, I'll tell you what happens. You're wondering, what are we gonna do tonight? Well, it's gonna be 12 degrees outside. Why don't we do movie night? And that little voice inside's like, yes, movie night. Because he knows movie night always starts here. Yeah, I like this movie too. Yeah, he's a talented actor, but it always ends here. And there's a part of you that's like, movie night. But there's another part of you saying, you know what? That's not the way I wanna do this relationship. And so what do you got to do? If that always leads me here, then you may need to say, you know what? Movie night's not evil. Your apartment's not evil. But if I get in there, I'm going to get evil. So can we just maybe go to my apartment where there's like six people around, so I'll be much less likely to grope you? Like, can we start there? And you eliminate the moment. I talk to so many people that struggle with a porn addiction. And I say, how does it get you, man? I don't know. And you're like, man, think about it. Where does it get you? And so many of them say, you know what? It's on my phone late at night. I was like, yeah, man, you're most tired and vulnerable, and you're putting a whole universe of brokenness right into your world that we know doesn't just kind of mess with you sexually. It actually saps creativity. It saps some of your social ability. Like, this is not a good situation for human beings. How do we get out of it? I'm like, well, man, if that always leads here, maybe get your phone away from your head. And I'll have guys say, like, I don't know, it's my alarm clock. And you're like, well, buy an alarm clock. You're like an alcoholic pouring a glass of scotch every night and laying it by your head and be like, no, I'm not gonna drink you. It's a bad choice. You would tell him not to do that. Right? And so I eliminate that moment. And yet some of you go, well, Ben, what if the moment's my brain? What if every time I'm on my way to work or I'm sitting at my desk, just a torrent of negative thoughts come firing in and all of this kind of negativity that makes me feel bad about myself. I have no future. I'm never going to be anybody. I'm never going to get out of this. I'm never going to advance. I'm doomed to be just like my parents. I'm whatever. And you go, Ben, it's just, it's an onslaught. It doesn't matter physically where I am. It's an emotional and mental space that always leads me to then drown my sorrows in some toxic relationships or maybe an addiction. I end up in some dark places because of this relentless onslaught mentally and emotionally. How do I get out of that environment? Well, you might need some of us to help you. Get in a community where you can talk out loud what you're dealing with. AA, they say we're only as sick as our secrets. Some of you, one of the best gifts God's given us is us. You need some friends to talk to you. Or I know for me, when I was in college, there was a whole semester where that would happen to me. I didn't ask for it, wasn't looking for it, but just this wave of really toxic negative thoughts would just go zooming in my mind. I was like, I can't control this. I don't want this. I'm just walking on campus. I'm like, I can't even function socially how I want. I felt like it was making me crazy. And I was like, well, how do I get out of that? And for me, I thought, I just need to direct my thoughts somewhere else. Maybe I'm going to shift the music I'm listening to. It's just too much negativity I'm marinated in. But then there were moments where I'd be sitting in class and I'm like, I just can't get some of this out of my mind. I was like, I need to force my mind into a different zone. And I remember I thought, well, maybe I should memorize scripture. Do I have any memorized? And I thought, no, I don't have any memorized because I'm not good at that. And then in that moment, I thought, well, yeah, I do. The 23rd Psalm from when I was a little kid. There was a guy that used to always come during Sunday school in the middle of craft time, and he'd kick the door open. He'd kick it because he's holding an accordion, and with an accordion, you need both hands. And he'd kick it open. Hey, kids! And I remember he would sing over us the 23rd Psalm, and I was like, I got that loaded. I didn't even know I had it. So there in the middle of this crisis moment in college, I remember sitting there, and in the edge of my binder, I'm right now, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, he makes me lie down in green paths. And I'm like, I got it. And after a couple months, I didn't even need the polka beat to write it out. But for me, it started to steer my mind out of this negativity of the Lord is my shepherd, so I shall not want, I'm gonna be okay. He leads me beside cool waters. He restores my soul. That he's going to lead me through the valley of the shadow of death. I believe that. And begin to move out. If this always leads me here, how do I get out of this? Right? How do I get out of it? I eliminate the moment. And for some of you, you may just have to look and go, there's some things in my life that got to get out. Remember, we had a girl in our ministry years ago, a young girl that had an eating disorder, was really doing some damaging things to her body. And we started to talk to her about it, and there's some deeper emotional issues, as usually there are. And yet we said, hey, let's just go. And I remember one of the girls in our ministry went to her house, and her house was wallpapered with pictures of models from magazines, which, you know, Photoshop, not even accurate, but it was just filling her life with this shame, and you don't measure up. And we said, you know, let's address some of these deeper emotional things, but to start, what if we take some of these images down? And I don't know anybody that does that with their wall anymore. You don't need to. It's just on your phone. It's the relentless onslaught of comparison. I listened to a psychologist yesterday talk about that, saying, hey, I have to get off Twitter because I've just realized it was stealing from me sleep. It was making me anxious, which was making me irritable. I wasn't being the kind of person I want to be in relationships. And I realized it's because this constant barrage of information is harassing me. And so for my own health, I have to limit how often I'm on my phone for my own sanity. And so if this moment leads me there, how do I eliminate this moment? And let me tell you something. Some of you go, Ben, is this legalism? No, this is wisdom. I know some people that they just can't go to bars anymore, man. They had a really abusive relationship with alcohol, and they go, dude, as soon as I show up there, the sights, sounds, smells, I know it's just the clock starts ticking. It's only a matter of time before I start making a series of bad choices. I just can't even enter that space. My buddies and I got to hang somewhere else. But I've had other friends that they're like, bars don't bother me at all. No big deal at all. But I remember I had one buddy that bars don't bother him at all, but bookstores? Because he had a habit of going to bookstores and finding books and looking up images that would kind of stir up lust in him that made him really an unhealthy person. He's like, I don't want to be that person. And he's like, this sounds so stupid, but I just got to not go to that bookstore anymore. And so for some of you, it means bookstores, but no bars. Some of you, it means bars, no bookstores. I don't know what it is for you. The key is to be a good student of yourself. If this always leads me there, how do I stay out of this? But if you go, well, Ben, if I'm in temptation, how do I fight it? Well, James gives us two things. One, he says, paddle downstream. If you're in a moment of temptation where you go, that looks good to me, what do I do? He says that when we are lured and enticed by our own lust, When lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. The verbs he uses aren't fishing verbs, they're pregnancy verbs. He says, you need to look and think, if I unite myself with this lust, she's gonna have a baby named sin. And sin's gonna have a baby called death. And if I don't want death, I need to step out of this relationship. And once temptation comes, it looks attractive, it looks life-giving, but you have to force yourself to look downstream and say, do I want to be there? No, then I need to get out of here. I've got a buddy in ministry that in his prayer closet, he's got newspaper clippings of pastors who have failed morally. And you go, wow, what an upbeat closet. Why would you do that? Well, he had pictures there to remind himself because he said, Ben, it happens. Once you start counseling people, people start coming up to you and telling you how great you are and all that's good. There's a really healthy way to do it. He said, but if you're not careful, you can get into an unhealthy way to do it. And a lot of pastors don't create healthy boundaries on how to treat women. And so they start creating unhealthy ones and they get in an unhealthy relationship and they ruin their marriage and their life and their family and everything. And he said, and I don't want to be that guy. So on the way out the door of his prayer closet, there's a newspaper clipping, and there was a photo on the front page of this news, and it's the guy when he's getting caught, and he's next to his wife as the news media is surrounding their car, and he had circled her face, and he said, look at her eyes. I mean, why would you do that? Because he's looking at this guy's bride, and she just had this hollow look in her face, and he said, I know that in a moment of temptation, this is going to seem like such a good idea. And I need to look at the end of it and say, you know what? Adultery looks a lot less sexy in the cold light of day. Now, if this has been your story, is there grace and redemption for you? Yes. Everyone in here is a mess and everyone in here is a candidate for the grace of God. And yet as we begin to walk with him, we look and say, I don't want to be there. And so when I'm here and that sounds good, I need to look and say, no, that's not going to get me where I want to be. That addiction doesn't bring life. That toxic relationship isn't healthy. I know that's not good. So if I can look downstream, I can look and say, I got to get out of here. This is trouble for me. And then you paddle upstream and you say, wait a minute, this temptation has a power because I'm believing something about it. And some of us feel that. You go, I know that's an unhealthy choice, but it's still attractive. Why? This is where the work comes to paddle upstream, because every deception gives power to addiction. That's how it works. A lie believed equals a wound received. And then we will go to find comfort in some very dark places. And so James will say, don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. He said, I love you, and you need to know that this is a deception. And then it's interesting. He doesn't point downstream. He doesn't say, don't be deceived. That's a bad relational choice. Don't be deceived. That addiction won't solve it. Don't be deceived. That's an unhealthy place to process your pain. He doesn't say that. He says, don't be deceived. Every good and perfect gift comes down from your Father, in whom there's no shadow or shifting or varying due to change. He says the lie that launches a million sins is the lie that God doesn't love you and isn't a good dad. Think about it. That if I look at that and don't believe he has what's best for me, then I gotta take my sexuality in my own hands. I don't believe the way he tells me to find comfort's gonna work, so I'm gonna find my comfort in a bottle. I don't believe the way he says living life is healthiest way to use my gifts, so I'm gonna chase success for validation. And so many of us, the way we live our lives, we end up in unhealthy places and you go, what's the lie I believe? I'm doing all this crazy stuff physically to present an image. Why are you doing that? Because in my heart of hearts, I believe that I am not lovable until I look lovely enough. And that's not true. While we were a sinner, Christ died for us. You gotta fight the battle back here. Or some of you say, I gotta be a success and I will begin to cut corners and ravage my body by working crazy hours to be a success. And you go, why? Is it to use your gifts for the common good? No, it's not even about that. What's it for? For validation. Why? Because I don't feel like I'm worthy. And I gotta do something worthy in order to be worthy of love. And you gotta fight the battle there. That lie is fueling that addiction. So fight the lie. If you decided today you hate me, if that became your new goal, January 2019, destroy Ben Stewart. Like if that was your New Year's resolution. Let me give you a secret of how to do it, okay? Let me just pull the cards. You wanna lay, I just wanna destroy Ben's life. Here you go. Here's the worst thing you could possibly do to me. Convince my little daughters for a second that their daddy doesn't love them. That I wouldn't give my life in a second for them. The most evil thing you can do to me. is to lean down and look into the face of my kids and say, your daddy doesn't have your best interest in mind. Your daddy wouldn't give his life for you. Your daddy doesn't care about you. You're a disappointment to him. You're not measuring up. His love's conditional and you are not meeting the conditions. If you did that to my kid, you would unlock a world of rage in me. How dare you? The worst thing you could do is to convince my kids I don't love them with all my heart. Do you see the lie? That's what the enemy has done to so many of you. And he has led you down wayward paths to broken streams to find water when the reality is an ocean of grace is here for you. So you got to make war on that lie because he wants you to believe your God doesn't love you. And so you make war on that. Don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift comes down from your Father. Of his own will, he brought you forth as a first fruit of his creatures. It was his decision to make you alive and to love you. You believe that. And those who know they are fought for make the best fighters. Those who know my God fought for me will begin to believe I don't have to go there anymore. I don't have to get that person's validation. I don't have to go to that place for comfort. I have a fountain. I don't need that broken cistern. I have a fountain in my God who loves me. We fight the battle there. And last thing I'll say is we don't do it alone. Flee youthful lust. Pursue righteousness, faith, and love and peace along with those who call out to God out of a pure heart. You come run with us after him. You come join us and run. Community groups, Mike mentioned, coming to church, just get to know people. Surround yourself with people who love him. Because here's the bottom line. Ultimately, the best defense against our struggles is a good offense. The Puritans used to say it this way. How do you dislodge a beautiful thing from the human heart? You replace it with a more beautiful thing. How are we going to stop going to these broken cisterns to satisfy our thirst? You come to the fountain. How did Romeo get rid of Rosalind? How did Romeo get rid of Rosalind? Do y'all remember Rosalind? Anybody? Romeo and Juliet, William Shakespeare, anyone? Hello? Yeah? Heard of it? You remember at the beginning? Romeo's all hot and bothered about Rosalind, going on and on. Rosalind's so beautiful. Rosalind's the best. My heart is incomplete without Rosalind. Like, on and on he goes until finally Benvolio's sick of it. It was like, dude, I'm taking you to a party tonight and there's going to be like 100 girls hotter than Rosalind. It's a rough translation. It's like the Message version, but look at it. It's there. What does Romeo say? The all-seeing sun has ne'er met her match since first the world begun. Oh, nothing could replace Rosalind. Then he goes to the party and he sees Juliet. And that night, he sneaks into her yard and says, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks? It's the east and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, which is already sick and pale with grief that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she. Rosalind, who? The way you begin to dislodge your addiction to broken things is to begin to stir your affection to the most beautiful thing. Yes. You fall in love with the God who loves you. You embrace the Jesus who gave all for you. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends, and he laid down his life for you, friend. My beloved brothers and sisters, don't be deceived. Every good and perfect gift comes from your Father above. You draw near to him with us, and you watch this movement begin, your quality of life begin. He has set you free. Now we can live like it.
If you were encouraged by today's talk and believe it would be uplifting to others, then be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church podcast.